Good morning, everybody. We're here today for oral arguments. We're going to begin with case number one, which is Appeal 20-1725, Otis Elion v. United States. We're going to begin with argument from Mr. Roper.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the Court. Aaron Roper as court-appointed amicus in support of appellant Otis Elion. Mr. Elion received a sentence over double his correct guidelines range because his lawyer fundamentally misunderstood the categorical approach. For two independent reasons, the government cannot show with certainty that Elion's state law convictions match the guidelines. First, Illinois lookalike convictions do not require that the substance be made with intent to deceive. And second, Illinois criminalizes advertising, conduct outside the guidelines as part of one indivisible offense. Counsel's failure to raise either argument was both prejudicial and deficient, and indeed, the government no longer defends counsel's actual reasoning. I'd like to begin this morning with the counterfeit issue briefly, because I think it provides the most straightforward basis for reversal in light of the government's concessions in its supplemental brief. The government now says that to match the guidelines, a counterfeit substance has to be made with intent to deceive. But the government never attempts to show how Illinois law possibly satisfies the government's own definition. Nothing in the text of Section 404, nothing in the definition of lookalike substance in 102Y, nothing in any of the Illinois cases remotely suggests that state prosecutors have to prove anything about the manufacturer's intent. So right there, on the basis of the government's own definition, there's a plain mismatch on the face of the statute, and Elion is not a career offender. So that alone requires reversal.
If we were to conclude that there was an intent to deceive facet to counterfeit, and we were to play that down the board and conclude, therefore, that there would have been prejudice in the career offender designation, what do we do with the performance prong?
If you were to just address the counterfeit issue, I think it would be helpful to also address the divisibility argument so that we have the full scope of counsel's errors. But just looking at the counterfeit issue alone, I do think it would still be deficient performance. Then we would set aside counsel's affidavit because she just doesn't talk about this issue at all. So I think if we just had this issue, a remand would be helpful to develop the record on that score. But I do think it would still be deficient to raise the argument. I mean, there's no strategic reason to forego what is by hypothesis a winning categorical approach argument.
What about the case law, though, that was coming down, albeit unpublished, indicating that making this kind of mismatch argument would have been frivolous?
I think with respect to those two cases, those were just addressing a different kind of argument. In all of these cases, the real fight was whether to apply sort of a term of art meaning of counterfeit or to apply the plain meaning. No counsel was, and no court was considering whether defendants would prevail under the plain meaning argument. So I think they're just an opposite. And of course, those decisions are unpublished for a reason. This court accepting honors motions to withdraw doesn't make law because the court isn't fully considering the scope of the argument.
Would we be creating a circuit split, though, if we took this approach?
No, I think the Illinois statute is materially distinguishable from all the stimulated controlled substances statutes because those are generally look at whether the substance purported to be a controlled substance, which I think it looks a lot more like intent to deceive. The one problematic decision is the Eighth Circuit's decision in U.S. v. Robertson, which does address the Illinois statute. But the problem for the government there is that if you read the Eighth Circuit's opinion, they just misquote the statute. And the government doesn't attempt to rehabilitate that reasoning. So I guess in some technical sense, there's a split with how that court resolved the bottom line. But I would hope that that court, you know, reading the statute again, reading the court's opinion, realizing they made a typo, would reconsider its approach in that case.
Mr. Roper, while we're on the ineffective assistance question there, yes. What's the point of a remand?
I think now that the government has put the performance prong fully in play, the court could resolve the issue against them. But I think a remand, if the court isn't going to go that far, would be helpful to develop the record on counsel's reasoning. I mean, specifically on the counterfeit issue, we don't actually know anything about her reasoning. Her affidavit just doesn't talk about the issue at all.
Yeah, I guess if you step back a little bit, what if we credit your position, you prevailed on the merits of it that way. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, isn't there some futility then on the remand around the performance prong? Because what you have concluded, of course, is that there's a demonstration of prejudice on prong two under Strickland. that way. And wouldn't it almost kind of ipso facto be deficient performance to miss a winning argument? And so I'm just thinking to myself, what transpires in the district court against the backdrop of a Seventh Circuit opinion saying, you got a winner here?
Yes.
That look like?
I mean, I think the court could fully go ahead and resolve the performance prong in our favor. In our opening brief, we asked for a remand because we took this circuit's precedent to afford counsel an opportunity to explain herself. But now that the government wants to rest on performance, I think, yes, you could definitely say, I mean, we have an affidavit from her explaining her reasoning. It's wrong on its face. It's plain she misunderstood the categorical approach. And I agree that that's going to be very hard to rehabilitate on remand. So I don't want to fight that premise too much because I do think it would be a little futile here. There's nothing the government can do if you agree with us that these arguments are winners on the merits and that counsel flatly misunderstood and misjudged them. That mistake of law is going to be deficient performance.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I could think of is that you go back down and on the performance prong in a hearing or something, you say, well, I read the Seventh Circuit opinion. Yeah, it's a winner. I missed it. Why did I miss it? Because of the extraordinary complexity of this area of law and the ability to, foresee all these arguments and what have you. And then the question is there any legal viability to that strain of argument?
Right. I think that this court has already squarely rejected that strain of argument in Bridges and Harris. This court says that legal complexity is not an excuse. Defense attorneys need to understand the law. It's their job to do the research and figure out what the answer is. So, yes, I think if that's all they've got, there's no need for a remand. The court could directly resolve the issue and order resentencing. I do think it would be helpful for the court to address the divisibility issue, though, if you're not, because I think that is where counsel's error is most obvious on the face of her affidavit.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
Just to get the benefit. I mean, your briefs are excellent. I mean, everybody's read them and prepared. The hypothetical you have about the guy hawking the rice on the street corner.
Yes.
Okay. You state it well. I totally get it. What's the legal underpinning of the reasoning why he can't be convicted of the four or five offenses? What's doing the legal work there?
I think it's a legislative intent question. The point of that hypothetical is to illustrate that this would have been a weird decision for the Illinois legislature to create four separate crimes. Obviously, they could. The Illinois legislature could have written a statute that says advertising is a felony, distribution is a felony, manufacturing is a felony. So the point of that hypothetical is to illustrate that, that would have been a strange statute for the Illinois legislature to write because all of this conduct is overlapping, they're compact. This would be a strange thing to think that a state legislature would want to turn into four separate and distinct crimes for which someone could be punished separately.
Okay, is there a next step in that reasoning and therefore the multiplicity doctrine kicks in or not?
I mean, it really just boils down there to what did the Illinois legislature did. It would be multiplicitous under our reading of the statute. That would not be multiplicitous under the government's reading of the statute because those are distinct crimes. And our point is that it would be weird to write for the Illinois legislature to have written a statute where that's not multiplicitous because you could have a quadruple conviction for what is really one drug transaction.
But it's really statutory construction is what you're saying. What's doing the work there is just the interpretation of the statute by virtue of the way it was structured by the General Assembly.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes. Our point is that, as a baseline, I think the certainty requirement is the easiest way to get at the divisibility argument because Elion has a mountain of evidence that Illinois courts would and do treat the statute as divisible, and the government's handful of contrary points aren't going to be able to establish state law with certainty. We've already talked about the statutory text. I think another very powerful indication in Elion's favor is the Illinois Supreme Court decisions that when faced with statutes that on their face look far more distinct and far more like divisible statutes, the Illinois Supreme Court has held those statutes to be indivisible. So as a matter of Illinois law, it's very hard for me to see how this statute falls on the divisibility line, much less certainly on the divisibility side of the line. And that's borne out in practice. We've identified 8 real-world Illinois decisions where courts appear to have entered Section 404B convictions in the alternative. On the government's reading of the statute, every one of those convictions violates the Sixth Amendment's jury unanimity requirement. I think that's a troubling result, and that's one of the reasons we have the certainty requirement, so that federal courts aren't accidentally casting doubt on state convictions. If the court were to look outside Illinois law, as the government would have you do, I think the obvious place to start is this circuit's precedent interpreting very parallel language in Section 841A1 to be indivisible, the federal drug statute. The government doesn't really have responses to these points, and given that they need to show the meaning of Illinois with law with certainty, I think that basically dooms their challenge.
Can I ask you on this same issue, just for purposes of discussion here, assume that we hit a point of concluding that the divisibility analysis here is, it just doesn't lend itself to clear answers, okay? I know that's not what you're urging, but just assume that. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then let's assume that we invoke the safety valve in Mathis. You know what I'm talking about?
The record documents, yes.
Yeah, the record documents safety valve in Mathis, that way. When we look at the record documents here, okay, don't they help us on the divisibility question? It's, you're not looking at the record documents to apply like the modified categorical approach. I get that, okay? Right. But when you look at the record documents from the 2000 conviction, as you have, mm-hmm. right, there's no question that there are facts in that indictment, but the facts appear under the provision of notice alleging, you know, the offense in question. And it says unlawful delivery. It could say unlawful advertising, you know, any number of things that way. Doesn't that help us, not hurt us? And what I have a difficulty with is it seems to fit precisely in an example that the court provides in the Mathis majority opinion.
Right. I think the fundamental problem with that, though, is that this court already recognized in Parsich that Illinois record documents do routinely contain these extraneous factual details, and not just in sort of the factual.
But we did that in Parsich after already concluding that the statute was indivisible and responding to counter arguments.
Yeah, I do think that was part of the court's holding in that case. I mean, it's, the court recognized that, I mean, the record document there said intent to commit theft, and the courts held, even though that was like listed in the description of the crime, that that wasn't an element of the offense. But you know, even if you're looking at the record document, and even if you spot the government that delivery really means distribution, I think the fundamental problem for them is that they still need certainty. And it's not like when we get to the record documents, you throw out everything you already know about Illinois law. So to the extent, if you think that this is a point in their column, I think it's a fairly small point. When Elion has a mountain of evidence about, you know, other state convictions. I mean, presumably those eight cases we've identified, the record documents in those cases presumably say distribution or manufacturing. I don't know what else they would possibly say or why the courts would have described the convictions that way. And I think the problem here is that there's sort of an asymmetry, at least in Illinois, about what prosecutors can put in the record documents, because, you know, if there's multiple alternatives listed, that means the statute has to be indivisible or that conviction is unconstitutional. But the state is always free, at least in Illinois, to take on a higher burden for itself to just prove one of the alternatives. And that might well be a sensible thing to do if your only theory of the case is that the defendant sold the lookalike substance. There's no need to write manufacturing in the indictment and just potentially
charge. I mean, all you're saying with that is that it's just possible they charged it as a means.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I think the record documents, I think Parsich is really dispositive of whether you should be looking at them, but if you don't buy that, even if you're looking at them, even if you read it the way the government does, I don't see how it can meet the certainty burden given all of the other points on Elion's side of the column. Besides the record documents, the other thing the government is relying very heavily on is the Illinois pattern jury instructions. I think it's sort of a similar problem there. Mathis requires authoritative sources of state law, but in Illinois, the pattern instructions aren't authoritative. They're drafted by an advisory committee that's primarily made up of lawyers and law professors, and they're not approved in advance by the Illinois Supreme Court. So they're not an authoritative statement of state law. And again, I think this is also a similar story to the record documents. Even if you do look at them, they don't help the government as much as the government thinks. I mean, the instruction itself just lists all the alternatives in parentheses. There's no indication that the court couldn't list multiple alternatives. Instead, the government is going to the advisory committee comment that says in certain unspecified circumstances, courts may have to give a multiple jury forms. I don't know exactly what that means, although I'd note that the principal instruction that we're talking about here isn't just for 404B. It also covers simple possession. And so there are multiple crimes covered by that instruction. If you're going to charge simple possession, which is a petty offense, it's clearly divisible from the rest of Section 404, and a normal Section 404 offense in the same document, those obviously have to have a different jury forms because they're two different crimes given the different penalties. So again, I don't think you should be looking at the pattern instruction. If you do look at it, I don't think it helps the government as much as they think it does. So that, I think, really is, disposes of the merits on the divisibility and on the counterfeiting issue, and that leaves us with what to do on the performance prong. We've already talked a little bit about this, Judge Scudder, but I think the court basically has three approaches there. One, you could just remand it back to the district court. The district court only addressed the prejudice inquiry, and so the court isn't obligated to go farther than that. At the other end of the spectrum, I think the court could properly go ahead and resolve the issue, the case in Elion's favor at this point, and order a new sentencing. The government has put the performance prong fully in play, yet the government doesn't even acknowledge counsel's mistake. The government doesn't attempt to rehabilitate her reasoning. The government doesn't point to anything it would possibly offer on remand. Indeed, it says there are no factual disputes here. So I think the court could go ahead and resolve the case in our favor. Or third, the court could sort of take a middle approach, reaffirm that a mistake of law is deficient performance, point out counsel's error here, reaffirm that legal complexity and difficulty aren't legitimate reasons that can excuse counsel's performance, but then let the district court do the bottom line analysis in the first instance. Given that Mr. Elion will presumably be pro se on remand, I do think there would be value in this court saying something about the performance prong, either resolving it outright or at least providing a strong signal that, you know, counsel's mistake of law that's patent at page A62 of the appendix is troubling and problematic. But again, that's ultimately something in the court's discretion.
Are you saying if we remand, you're going to abandon him at this point?
Well, I'm not his lawyer, so.
Oh, yes, that's true. Yes. That's true.
I'm here on your behalf. So
you to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, I'd reserve my time. Thank
Very
you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Roper. We'll now hear from the government. Mr. Reed.
In 2012, this court agreed with defense counsel that any challenge to the use of an Illinois look-alike conviction would be frivolous. It explained, we and at least four sister circuits have rejected similar arguments involving the Illinois look-alike statute or other comparable state statutes. It's against this backdrop that this court should consider counsel's performance and whether that performance prejudiced Mr. Elion on both prongs of Strickland. As to prejudice, petitioner has the burden of showing a reasonable probability or a substantial likelihood the sentencing court would have acted differently if an argument had been raised. We know there was little probability of a different result because this court had labeled such arguments frivolous. And this is very similar to the Ballard case out of the Sixth Circuit, where the court looked at the state of the law at the time. Really, the law hasn't changed here in this circuit. But in Bullard, the question was, look, is there a categorical mismatch here or not? Well, if there is a precedent out there that says it's not a categorical mismatch, as there is here, stating that the Illinois look-alike statute does not create a categorical mismatch, we can take a pretty good guess as to what that trial court would have found had defense counsel raised that argument. Would have found that there was there's very little probability of a different result, and therefore no prejudice to Mr. Elion from defense counsel's performance. As to the deficient performance prong, that directs the court, to answer Judge Scudder's question, that directs this court to look at what prevailing professional norms were at the time defense counsel appeared at sentencing in 2017. And we know what prevailing professional norms were at the time because those decisions in Green and Fenegar tell us what prevailing professional norms were. Defense counsel said, I see a wall of precedent at least four circuits, including a decision from the Eighth Circuit saying that this argument is no good. And in light of that, I think this argument is frivolous. And again, there's a big gap here between the Anders standard of whether an argument is so frivolous that it cannot be ethically raised by defense counsel, and the Strickland standard, which is way over here, which is the argument is so good that it must be raised by defense counsel or else they're constitutionally deficient. There's this huge gap in between those two standards of reasonable performance, and where the counsel is engaged in objectively reasonable performance, there's no Strickland violation. Again, Anders is way over here, Strickland is way over here. This court said this kind of argument was over here, and counsel can rely on that.
Mr. Reed, what are we to do with the argument that our court should read an intent to deceive mens rea into a guideline?
Judge, I would say two things. With regard to the federal guideline statute, I believe opposing counsel mistakenly has mischaracterized the government's argument. I just don't think it's right to read an intent requirement into a dictionary definition, to read a dictionary definition like a statute, right? So when Robertson cites a definition for counterfeit, it's talking about what does the word counterfeit mean? It's not saying let's look at Merriam-Webster to define the elements of this offense. And what Robertson looks at, it says, look, it says counterfeit. Counterfeit means made in a way, it's to look like it's counterfeit, you know, counterfeit money. It's made to look like something else. That doesn't create some kind of intent requirement. But even if it did, and I think this is the more important point, every court that has looked at this Illinois lookalike statute has found an intent to deceive requirement. I'd point the court to this court's or to the Illinois appellate court's decision in Prather, P-R-A-T-H-E-R. It said the statute's scienter requirement limits the reach of this lookalike statute to those who intend to pass off a non-controlled substance as a controlled substance. And that's precisely what was at issue in the Prather decision. The defendant had brought a vagueness challenge to the statute saying, I don't know when I how would I know whether I violated this statute? It asks whether some other person would think this was a lookalike offense. And the court said, because the statute requires you to intend to pass off a controlled substance or a non-controlled substance as a controlled substance. The only Illinois court decision to address the issue has found that the Illinois statute has an intent requirement. So there's no real reason to look at that Merriam-Webster definition and try to find some kind of intent requirement, because the only Illinois decision to have ever addressed it has said there's an intent requirement in the state statute, and so there can be no categorical mismatch.
Don't you think that conclusion follows from the text of the statute, too?
Yes, I do, and I'd point the court to the Robertson decision from the Eighth Circuit, right? So you have two different parts of the statute, and the question is whether there's an intent requirement. And again, as Robertson says and as Prather says, you don't look at a criminal statute and lightly read out an intent requirement. Criminal statutes have culpable mens rea requirements. And when you look at this statute, the first half has an intent requirement buried in the physical characteristics of the substance. The second half of the statute looks at the representations, the words of the defendant or the circumstances under which they're offered.
I mean, how would you knowingly distribute a lookalike substance without intending some form of deception?
That's my question, Judge. The only instance I can think of that you can hack that intent is the one addressed by the statute's exception, right? Where you think that you have the real thing, but it's actually just a lookalike substance where you're fooled too. And I think that exception doubles down on your...
Or what you could... the only thing I can think of is if you... Let's hypothesize a circumstance where a defendant sells something and he's not aware of the something he's selling. He doesn't know whether he's selling a lookalike substance, whether he's selling aspirin, or for that matter, whether he's selling a bicycle. But the Supreme Court has told us, has it not, at least at this initial stage of trying to measure overbreadth, that, look, there's got to be a reasonable probability of what you're hypothesizing coming to be. In other words, we shouldn't engage in just wild, fanciful hypotheticals.
That's right, Judge. And again, if you want to know what the statute says, every court that has asked whether that Illinois statute has an intent requirement has found that it does have an intent requirement. So not only are you... To use your words, engaging in mild hypotheticals, if you were to find in favor of Mr. Illion on this point, or really amicus, because Illion
So I think the harder, look, you, I mean, I think the harder issue you have is on advertising.
Sure.
Much harder. That way, if you took anybody listening to this morning's oral argument and you walked back there and you gave one of them the statutes and you set them side by side, you said, now just look at these two things and you tell me whether they're different. Everyone's going to say, oh, yeah, they're different. That Illinois statute has advertising in it, but the 4B definition of control does not. Okay, you'd say, well, they must have included advertising because it must mean something different than distribute, manufacture, because why else would you include it?
Judge, I think that the everybody would have said the same thing about this court's decision in Hudson, which is why you need to step through the analysis. So when we look at the advertising definition, we start with Mr. Ilion's argument, which is from the Fifth Circuit's decision in Hinkle and the Tenth Circuit's decision in Madkins. And in those decisions, the court looked at state law and found the statute criminalized only a mere offer to sell. And again, to clarify the government's position, this is what Ilion says about the Illinois advertising statute, that it criminalizes a mere offer to sell.
You can advertise something without, in a way that, you know, promotes a product but doesn't attempt to sell it.
Two things, Judge. First, Mr. Ilion, in his briefs, does not dispute that the statute requires an offer to sell. And in fact, he's the one who raised the idea that it criminalized a mere offer to sell. It is Amicus who disagrees with Mr. Ilion on that point. Second, I think that if you look at the actual definition of advertise and at the way the Illinois courts have defined that term, you can't advertise without an intent to sell. And on the statute—
What if I'm an advertising company and I'm just advertising to promote a product?
Again, Judge, you have to look at the way the term is defined. It has to be made—
I'm not selling it. I'm just doing the advertising.
It has to be made in a way to induce to acquire, right? It's a defined statutory term. It's not taking its common meaning. And the defined definition is induce to acquire. And when you look at the way American Daily read that language, what does it take to induce to acquire? Well, it takes formality, publication, dissemination, solicitation, or circulation, and it requires an offer to sell with intent to sell. American Daily is the only decision looking at advertising. It made this distinction between the party that has drugs to sell, and that's their distinction. The advertiser had lookalike substances to sell. The publisher did not have lookalike substances to sell. The court pointed, in American Daily, pointed to four facts as to why that publisher had not advertised. One, it had no pecuniary interest in the sale of lookalike substances. Two, it had no supplies from which to fill orders. Three, it was not a conduit for the sale of the pills. And four, it was not a willing participant in the illegal sale of lookalike drugs. If we look at those same factors in light of Your Honor's hypothetical, if I put out an advertisement that says, I like avocados, I don't have a pecuniary interest in the sale. I don't have any supplies from which to fill orders. I don't have a conduit for the sale of the pills, and I'm not a willing participant in the sale of avocados. And here, the context matters. We're dealing with illegal substances, right? You don't get an advertisement that says, go buy fentanyl, see the cartel, right? That's the context matters in this instance. I think building on that hypothetical, you can see the intent requirement in this statute as well for a couple reasons. Contrast an advertisement from a pharmaceutical that says fentanyl is a great painkiller, advertised in the traditional sense, right, but not advertised in the sense of this statute. Why? Because there's no intent to violate the law. Contrast that with cartel saying fentanyl is great, go see our dealers. That's a violation of the statute because there's an advertisement with an intent that's presenting a good for sale that they have a pecuniary interest in selling, and that they have an intent to sell.
If we shift you over to the divisibility issue for a second, what's your response to the hypothetical about the guy with the rice bags on the corner?
Judge, whenever the court is engaging in this kind of divisibility analysis, it has to make a choice between two different hypotheticals, right? Either under Amicus's position, you have to say that the government can charge a defendant with manufacturing and distributing, right? And the jury doesn't have to agree, doesn't have to be unanimous on which one it is. Or you have to say that it's charged in separate counts, right? This hypothetical, I would argue, is more extreme. I think that the statute
should be read. Let me give you a different one. Okay. Suppose we have a guy on the corner, and he has one baggie of heroin in his pocket, mm-hmm. at time zero, and at T plus one, he sells it. Can you convict him of two counts? One, possession with intent to distribute at T zero, and then distribution at T plus one.
Judge, you would charge both, but you would have a conviction that the convictions would merge, right? So the jury, you'd have
why?
Two jury for three.
Why?
Because the factual basis is the same, right? So you can't convict twice for the same conduct.
Conduct's different.
Well, but the conduct, and that's, I think.
So how's that different than Mr. Roper's rice business?
I don't think it is different than Mr. Roper's rice business. You can charge multiple crimes. But if the factual basis of both is the same, those merge after the jury verdict, and you're convicted with one sentence.
Okay, and nothing about 841 being indivisible changes that.
841A1, Judge.
841A1.
Right, Judge. So I agree with Amicus that these older cases, this older case Orzechowski from 1976 says what it says. I would suggest. And I'm not, this is me, not Department of Justice, but suggest that this is not the way this is charged in practice. If you were to look at the Seventh Circuit's jury instructions,
okay, as a legal matter, though, I mean, you can't overrule Seventh Circuit precedent. I know that. But as you stand there right now, do you think given everything we know from the Supreme Court about how to apply the categorical approach here, that 841A is indivisible as we stand here today? Forget our precedent. What do you think the right answer to that question is?
Judge, I think in practice that manufacturing and distributing are charged separately.
Okay. When you say in practice, does that mean as a legal matter? I'm not asking you to bind the Justice Department.
Sure.
You know this? What do you think the right legal conclusion to that question is?
I think the right legal question is that there's distinct elements and that they would be charged separately. And my basis for that is when I look at the jury instructions from this court.
It is divisible, not indivisible.
That it is divisible, Judge.
Right,
that
right.
They would be charged in separate counts. For the reason that I stated, the jury instructions list them as separate offenses. They're separate instructions for manufacturing and distributing in this court's instructions. And as a practical matter, I think the court would look at whether jury unanimity should be required as to manufacturer versus distributor.
Mr. Reed, can I ask you a question sort of back to the Strickland analysis here?
Yes, Judge.
Your argument on the lookalike substance is that it's not ineffective for counsel to raise because of our precedent, right? But if we just looked at our 841A1 precedent, and
right.
You've got Mathis, I mean, you've got a defendant here who pled guilty in the blind. There's no plea issues whatsoever. The whole ball game is sentencing, and here, a big part of the ball game is he going to be subject to these enhanced penalties and etc. And your argument on the lookalike substances is not ineffective for counsel to raise the issue with the district judge because even if counsel doesn't have to be perfect, even if Hudson was wrong and some of these other cases are wrong, doesn't matter. But what about the 841? Argument. We've got these older cases from the 1970s that say 841A1 is indivisible. Okay, 841A1 looks a lot like the Illinois statute. What makes counsel ineffective, or what makes a counsel effective in this case for not raising the divisibility issue on sort of the heels of Mathis?
Sure, Judge. Three quick answers. The first answer is that counsel could have looked at some Moncrief, the Supreme Court's decision about the Georgia statute, where it was read as a divisible statute, or any of a handful of decisions, Maldonado, Terran Salas, interpreting similar state statutes as divisible. Second, to your question about this particular defense counsel, her divisibility analysis simply assumes top-line divisibility, which is if the statute's divisible in some way, then we can look at the documents, the Shepherd documents. This court didn't resolve that issue until the Ruth decision in 2020. So when defense counsel is looking at this in 2017, her reading is certainly well within the realm of reasonable, objectively reasonable practice. Some courts were reading it as top-line divisibility, some were not. And certainly that's an argument that was being made as late as 2020. And third, while I'm on the topic of this particular defense counsel, practice. When you look through to the advertising argument, she says, I looked at Hinkle, which was the mere offer to sell case. I looked at Hinkle. I just don't think it, she didn't think it applied. The Seventh Circuit hadn't addressed it. In fact, the next year, the Seventh Circuit would reject a similar argument. And when you look at American Daily, had she followed through to that, I don't know whether she did. It doesn't say in the affidavit. American Daily says you got to have something more. There's a formality requirement. There's a requirement of intent to sell. And so what this counsel did was perfectly reasonable in light of the law at the time, not only as to divisibility, which was an issue, not top line divisibility, which was not resolved until Ruth in 2020, but also as to advertising. She went and looked at Hinkle and said, I don't see this. And I don't see it either, as we sit here today. When you look at the case law in American Daily, it's just not there. When you look at the facts that American Daily looked at, they simply don't apply in that kind of generic influence or promote definition of advertise that's being promoted by Amicus. You have to look through at those specific facts that the Illinois court looked at. Was there a pecuniary interest in the sale? Were there supplies to fill orders? Was there a conduit for the sale of pills? And were there a willing participant in the illegal sale of look-alike?
Mr. Reed, Mr. Roper's brought up the Robertson case and a potential misreliance in that case on a misquote. What is your response to that?
Judge, I just don't think that it influences the court's reasoning. The court looks at both Y1 and Y2 and explains very carefully why it thinks an intent is required. And I think the bigger point from Robertson and from Prother is that you don't lightly look at a state statute, criminal statute, and read out an intent requirement. That's rare. We don't do that. It's a criminal statute, has a mens rea, and you should read it that way if you can read it that way. Briefly, in my last 30 seconds, to address remand on the performance prong. Judge, I think there is a question about what prevailing professional norms are. I don't think it's a fact issue in this case because we can look at Green and Fenegar. This court can certainly affirm on the performance prong because it can confirm on any basis raised by the prevailing party. I don't think that it can reverse on the performance prong because it has not been addressed in the first instance by the district court. So for these reasons, I'd urge an affirmance.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reed. Mr. Roper, rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. 3 points on ineffective assistance, advertising, and then the counterfeiting issue. On ineffective assistance, the government's trying to reframe this issue, this case around the performance prong. I heard a lot at the beginning of counsel's argument, trying to sort of bleed performance into prejudice. That's not this circuit's approach. I think Bridges lays out a clear framework here. You answer the legal question in the first instance. If Elion's a career offender, if he was not prejudiced, if he isn't a career offender, he was prejudiced. And then we go on to performance. On the performance prong, the government was suggesting that this was somehow unclear or that counsel's reasoning was plausible in 2017. That's not right. This court in U.S. v. Lynn in 2017, before Elion sentencing, recognized that top-line divisibility is not enough. We cited that in our brief. The government didn't respond to it. Also, in Mathis, the Supreme Court made abundantly clear that the entire point of the categorical approach is to identify the elements of the conviction, and counsel didn't do that. She just treated Section 407's divisibility as a whole as dispositive without actually looking at Mr. Elion's elements. On the advertising issue, I never heard an explanation from the government of where they find an offer to sell in the statute. If you read the text of Section 404A1, which defines advertising, it says that it covers indirectly attempting to induce someone to acquire something. That is not an offer to sell. Instead, the government seems to be trying to get a concession out of Elion's pro se brief on that score. I didn't hear a response to the actual arguments about what the statutory text requires. On the intent to sell requirement, the government is trying to divine an intent to sell requirement out of the 38-year-old decision in American Daily Publishing by the Illinois Intermediate Appellate Court. I don't think that is dispositive. There's no intent requirement in the text. And if you read that decision, the court is explaining why the publisher there was not liable because he was publishing the substance. He was publishing the advertisement. He wasn't himself the advertiser. On the counterfeit issue, I agree the statute has a mens rea requirement. It's knowledge. The actions have to be done knowingly. Knowledge is not the same as intent to deceive. We have different mens rea standards in the law for a reason. Instead, the statute turns on the objective perception of a reasonable person, and that can be satisfied in a case like People v. Upton in the Illinois Intermediate Appellate Court case, where you have a defendant who says, I knew I was selling caffeine pills. My buyers knew they were buying caffeine pills. But if the caffeine pills objectively look like amphetamines, that violates the statute. In case after case, the way the state convicts in these cases is it puts a police officer on the stand who testifies that he knows what illegal drugs look like, and when he first saw these substances, he thought they were an illegal substance. That's an objective, reasonable person standard. It's not a deceit standard. I heard the government also trying to walk back today its concession in its opening brief that an intent to deceive standard is, quote, necessary to convict. That's on page 14 of their brief. If you have doubts about whether Hudson imposed that standard, I think you should hold them to their concession. You don't need to say anything about what federal law actually requires. They've conceded in this case that it's made with intent to deceive. The statute, even if it requires the defendant's intent, obviously doesn't require the manufacturer's intent. So for all those reasons, we would urge the court to reverse the decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roper. Mr. Roper, you have the thanks of the court, as well as to your law firm for all the excellent work. Mr. Reed, excellent work. Thank you very much for the presentation. The case will be taken under advisement.